And for inclusion on this task force is broad-based in the community. It includes legislative representatives, representatives of the administration, and members of the community from a broad base. We're talking prevention here. We're talking about bringing people together to talk about how we can prevent this problem. If we're talking about what to do after they're pregnant, we've gotten them too late. In closing, Senator Pierce wanted me to tell you that she sees this as a statewide issue and an issue that affects each of us. And she asks for your support on this task force and on this project and hopes that the bill can move on. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Fisher.
Yeah, thank you. I understand that there's no 21A range for a 7-month dormant interim, basically in person. I understand Senator Pierce has, she pulled the 21A because this was a range of some other study. And she's not bent that it's got to be a 21A, it could be something less.
In my conversation with her yesterday, she indicated that she was not going to live or die on this 21. She does think that it is the appropriate level, given the type of work it is and the level of person you would need to complete that work.
Senator Binkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It may be that 21A is appropriate. My concern would be that rather than have a separate fiscal note, is that this should be handled through the legislative leadership budget, which does have, in my opinion, enough room to hire a 21A or whatever's appropriate, 2019. To perform the task rather than have an individual fiscal note on it, that it be handled through the legislative leadership account. I wonder if Senator Pierce has explored that or looked at that option.
We would have no objection to that. We felt that it was our obligation to come to the committee with honest numbers at this point, as we understood them.
I was trying to think, how did we do the Family Support Task Force last year, Carol? You remember, was it, we reduced the fiscal note or something, but we still had fiscal note on it. But it wasn't $60,000. Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There's a $1,000 fiscal note on there for the Department of Education, too, and I would suggest that we zero that out. It's silly to put a fiscal note on $1,000. Senator Binkley.
They can absorb that in their budget. Mr. Chairman, meetings in each of the judicial districts, but I don't see that. I'm scanning through the bill here.
How much was our fiscal note?
25.
Joe, is there any schedule or any idea of where you're going to have meetings around the state? Is it in the resolution itself?
No, it just says one in each judicial district.
Page 3.
Or that it will meet in at least every judicial district.
Page 3, line 7. Okay, that was my concern. I know that you gave some pretty alarming statistics. About the birth rates in Alaska, you know, particularly among the Alaska Native population, that it's 110 per thousand and rising, as opposed to the national trend, which is falling off and far lower than that, 60 in the state of Alaska, as opposed to 110 in the Native population. My concern that by just holding hearings in the different judicial districts, for example, most of my district, which is primarily rural and Native, in its composition is all in the same judicial district as Fairbanks. And so if you were to have a hearing, for example, in Fairbanks, that would satisfy the requirement of this resolution, yet might exclude a large number of people who might have some poignant testimony on this issue, and I think it would be good for the commission to get their input too. So I don't know if it's necessary to offer an amendment, but just to make a note that it would be, I think, beneficial for the commission to go out into the rural areas of Alaska and not necessarily just hit the judicial districts.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the reference that Senator Binkley is making is on page 3, lines 6 through 8, about a meeting in each judicial district. We were attempting to give broad coverage to the state while not increasing the cost substantially. And if we follow the lines of the Family Support Task Force, the use of the teleconference system worked very, very well, and we had good testimony from around the state, so we would certainly take your thoughts into consideration.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, while the teleconference does work efficiently, and it does give people an opportunity to testify from around the state in the rural areas also, it still is good, I think, for commission members to get the experience of sometimes traveling out to rural areas, meeting face-to-face with people who are directly involved, and sometimes the the impact of that is a little more felt a little bit more than just over the teleconference line.
Exactly.
Senator Fisher.
On page 3, on the one where we talk about the various people that govern from the point, I guess I have a concern if we just limit to public school classroom teacher. Why just not a school classroom teacher? Give the governor some flexibility, because why say that if you teach in a private school, you can't even be considered under your teacher? And I don't know, maybe that would just put in there because and I didn't catch it in test, but I want to try.
So you're suggesting taking out public?
Give the school classroom teacher, give the governor full flexibility, because he's the one choosing.
I think, is that all right?
There would be no objection. One other suggestion that's come in is to replace classroom teacher with health educator. But that's...
Well, he'll appoint whoever he wants to. Anyway.
Sure, I would say we then if we just strike public and just leave the option in school classroom.
Any objection? Sorry.
Where's that?
On line 1, page 3.
Is there objection to that? Sorry. Senator Binkley?
What'd you come up with on the fiscal note?
Well, we checked last year with the Family Support Task Force. We got $12,500 in federal funds and $12,500 in legislative funds from Legislative Affairs. And it was a real squeeze for us to do the whole thing. And Janet also indicated to me that it was very difficult getting that position funded. I think we did fund it, but it was difficult. So I think I think this fiscal note could be reduced somewhat, though. $79,000. I think some of that could be absorbed in the legislative budget and under leadership funds. However, maybe the position should be left as it is, and the travel should be reduced by. There's almost $40,000 in travel.
And Mr. Chairman, half of that travel is by legislators, which I'm sure can be absorbed by legislative leadership.
That's my point.
So maybe reduce that to $20,000.
That would be my suggestion: is to take $20,000 off of travel. That would give you 19.6, and that would reduce the fiscal note to 59.6. It's still on. Senator,
isn't that somewhat counter then to the concern that you had in getting people out beyond the larger areas in the four judicial districts? That was a concern I have, because I know that all of my district there, and probably part of yours, is in the fourth judicial district, and that's basic, and Anchorage is included in there too, so you could hold a hearing in Anchorage and satisfy the mandate here by meeting in a judicial district. I know that certainly if you're going to get out, you need to get to where the problems are.
Right.
And certainly regional areas are certainly important. You know, and I, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, like at least, you know, Dillingham is a core area, Mackinac is a core area, you know, the Pribilofs, you have problems there. You need to include one of the two islands out there. I don't see if you restrict the travel in that sense, then I think you're not going to get the full input. But,
well, I think we will, because there will be 6 members of the legislature, and that travel can be absorbed. That's half of the whole membership of the committee can be absorbed by the legislature. So it still allows an extra $20,000 for public member travel, and some of it will also be absorbed within the 3 commissioners' own budget.
Chairman,
I don't think it's going to be that restrictive.
The various commissioners, with the exception of Department of Education, for that $1,000, are all picking up their own travel. Every department is.
But is it being reflected in this fiscal note?
Not in the LAA fiscal note. Every department has submitted their own fiscal note, that the ones affected. The only one who came back with a less than zero fiscal note is Department of Education, because they don't usually go to this one particular district all that much. Everybody else said they could cover it.
Senator Binkley?
Well, just to follow up on your point, Mr. Chairman, it's not the intention of, by reducing the fiscal note on the travel amount to impede the members from traveling out to the rural areas. On the contrary, we want to encourage that. However, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, the only amount we are reducing is that travel of the legislators, which, if they have a desire, an inclination to go out to rural areas or any place in the state or the world, I don't seem to have any difficulty in finding the funds to do so. So I don't think it's necessary for us to add another $20,000 for the travel for legislators.
Okay, there's no objection. We'll go ahead and make the changes on that fiscal note to reflect a $20,000 reduction. Is there a motion to move the Senator Fisher?
Just a couple comments, and I know we got this in passing, and I know this is pretty well, but I did a lot of reading on the teen pregnancy. But it seems to me that, and I'm going to do this later, I'll tell you how to write it on the wrong. But if you take the studies that have been done, I went through 19 different studies, yet you all come up with the same conclusions, basically the same conclusions. I think we're going to come up with the same conclusions. And the reason why I'm questioning in range 21A, they're going to be looking at literature that's already been done. I don't think you're going to find that teenagers become pregnant any different than the United States. Causes being the same. That's what the conclusion will be. My concern is, though, that, and I think one of the conclusions would be self-health care, school health clinic. That's going to be a conclusion for the city. Then you're going to have a real problem with community, because some communities do not think that contraceptives should be passed out by school people. But that's going to be part of the other ones all come up with the same kind of conclusion. They say, but let it up to the local community. Another thing you're going to find is mandatory curriculum. And I don't think the legislature in this state so far has ever come up with a mandatory curriculum. And I don't think the school people will see that either. But it's going to be a recommendation, as I see it. And we're not going to then fund the curriculum. You know, we come out and say we want them to have a health curriculum or sex education by statute, and we're not going to give you a rule. So I think that's going to be another conclusion. The one which I hope that will come out, but some of the reports do have, is that there's got to be nature of an alternative to burden that going on. And I think that if that's part of the study, and I was hoping I was going to try to put amendments that weren't not to be considered as any alternative to pregnancy. But I'm going to let that go. But there are the three concerns I have. Other studies are often not the same thing. By going to the community, it's nice and all, but I'm not so sure
we can do what
we're going to learn. Yeah. Studies don't already have already found out. So with that, I mean, I don't have any objections. But there are the concerns I have. And we'll come back with a large fiscal number next year as to how to implement this thing. I hope that this group then has the money.
Well, I think it's interesting, this handbook on abstinence that's sort of here about the Girl Scout recommendation.
Yeah. That's a good
one. Actually, it's very good. It tells about, you know, abstinence and the voice for that. It does. It's very good. It's the fact that you need to read it. It's part of the packet. Is there objection to, is there a motion to move this out? Senator Duncan?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I move we report out, Senate concurrent resolution 38 with the fiscal note as reduced.
Just the LIA.
Yeah, the DOE fiscal note should be zeroed out and the LIA fiscal note should be added.
Okay, we are making some progress this morning. Thank you very much, Ms. Vanity. The next bill on the calendar is Senate Bill 366, an act related to the Dalton Highway. Senator Frank, are you ready,
yes,
available and willing?
We have a proposed change in one of the fiscal notes we'd like to committee to consider. Mr. Chairman, the bill would open the Hall Road, or the North Slope Hall Road, commonly, well, actually, it is legally now the Dalton Highway, from Disaster Creek to Prudhoe Bay, and right now it's closed from that point on, and this bill would simply open it. It's my feeling that it's a public road. It should be open to the public. We've had over a decade now of experience with the road, and it's, in my opinion, high time that we allow the public access to a public road. And there is a great deal of support for the legislation. There is some opposition from the North Slope Borough. Their objections have been primarily there's concern about trash hauling, trash accumulation and adequate fish and game protection. We have addressed both those issues, I feel, adequately through the inclusion of fiscal notes. We do propose that we reduce the public safety fiscal notes substantially. The Department of Public Safety has increased their request dramatically from previous years in two areas, or primarily just the communications equipment. They had asked for $1.8 million in communications equipment this year. We don't think it's necessary. They didn't ask for it 2 years ago when we had the bill in, and we don't think it's necessary to have special communications equipment up there. We have reduced the request from four people to three in our proposal, based on the fact that they were proposing to replace someone at 7 Mile that they had taken out a few years ago. And they wanted to put them back, plus they wanted to put two new people at Coldfoot, plus a person at Prudhoe. 7 Mile is quite close, or reasonably close, to Livengood, where they have a trooper stationed, and we feel that that area could be covered adequately by that person at Livengood. And then that would give them two fish and game personnel at Coldfoot and a trooper at Coldfoot and a trooper at Prudhoe Bay. The real legitimate concern as far as fish and game would be when the road is open and during hunting season. We propose that we fund this as a seasonal position, not a full year position, because Commissioner Hickey has the authority to and anticipates closing the road during the cold winter months. So we've got 5 months funding, or excuse me, 7 months funding, as opposed to a full year funding for the troopers. And so we've prorated the funds in that manner. We also have fiscal notes from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, mostly to increase some trash collection activities and to put in some facilities, some vault toilets in two locations so that travelers have some facilities there. The Department of Fish and Game would like $14,900 to monitor fish and game taking in that area, and I think that's very legitimate. I think that that's important to find out if there is increased taking of fish and game in the area. We need to know what it consists of so that we can address those legitimate needs to control, to manage the fish and game. We would propose the fiscal note, the new fiscal note that handwritten for public safety, plus the rest of the fiscal notes prepared by the departments, with the exception of DOA. DOA was for communications equipment and contractual, and they did not ask for that. As I said before, they didn't ask for that 2 years ago, and we think it's a little bit unnecessary at this point. This level of protection would be far and away greater than any other area of the state, any other comparable unpopulated area of the state, such as the Steese Highway, which is patrolled out of Fairbanks, Denali Highway, which has no trooper stationed on it. They have one at, I think they have one at Paxson and one at Healy on the other end of it. But they, we've got a 5 mile no hunting corridor on either side of the highway. So there are existing statutory protections, and we're providing a greater level of fish and game protection in this than really we would be in other areas of similar similar highway. So that, Mr. Chairman, I would see if there are any questions.
Okay, Senator Frank, let's just go through. This essentially is a combined fiscal note.
No, I'm sorry. This is just for the public safety. I think the other ones, with the exception of DOA, are reasonable, and I would support those.
Okay, let's go through those.
Relatively
before we do that, let's look at the bill. Senator Frank, the fiscal note would apply for the fiscal year starting next year in 1990, July 1st. However, the act takes effect June 1st, 1990. Wouldn't you want it to say July 1st, 1990?
Well, I guess that's a good inconsistency. We wanted to get the road open to the traveling public this year. In fact, Senator Pichot said he wanted to take a trip up there, so...
Well, I know, but I mean, my point is that there isn't going to be anybody there to handle the emergencies on the road. Unless they've got to give them some preparation time. If the beginning of the road is opened on July 1st, 1990, give them some preparation time.
Right.
It takes them a month to get the other end, so by the time to get there.
Mr. Chairman, I think they could work with that, 1 month without too much difficulty.
Besides, Pichot couldn't go in July. Can only go in June.
Senator Pichot will have to go the 1st of July. Okay, let's go through those other fiscal notes. DOT? How much is DOT's fiscal note?
DOT's is a total of 32 in operating funds and 92 in capital. So, of course, the capital would be a one-time expenditure, and the operating impact would be 32 on an annual basis.
Is there a need for a $4,000 for bear-proof litter barrels?
Well, I think I think that's a relatively small expense. I think the North Slope Borough, I'm trying to pay some attention to the legitimate concerns that have been raised by affected areas, and I think that is, I can understand it not wanting the area to be trashed out, and I think that's relatively small, and so I would support it personally.
That's where they have it.
Okay, so DOT, are there any questions on DOT's fiscal note? What's the next one, Senator?
We could go then to public safety, which is the one I'm proposing. It's the handwritten one that was passed out.
Okay, that, there's any questions on that?
Which one's this now? This one he passed out?
Yeah.
DOT.
Senator Fisher?
We're talking three temporary.
I'd call them seasonal. You know, because, yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to put in three part-time people here.
Okay, I didn't know if we'd put
them on. This is going to have to be typed out in the final form, too.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
my concern is, do they have to be academy graduates, or can they just hire somebody in this position? Because I don't know whether we have the troopers, even if you did put money in, as part of the full training program.
Well, I assume the department can produce the troopers if we provide the money. I haven't asked that question of them, but I assume
they can. From the hillside area out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Senator Fisher?
No, that's it.
Senator Binkley?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, the capital expenditure in FY91, what does that consist of, and where are the funds coming from for that?
The capital consists of trooper housing. They had asked for $400,000 to do a duplex at Coldfoot. I personally feel that's unreasonable. I had spoken with the Commissioner of Transportation, and he says that they can, that DOT would let them put trailer houses, or mobile homes, I should say, in their compound. So I think we were pretty liberal on giving them $70,000 to acquire two mobile homes, haul them up there, set them up, all for $70,000. I think they can do it. Based upon, you know, looking in the paper, we found some pretty nice.
HFC has some
good deals for them, and our DOT employees stay there, and it's not uncommon for they should be requiring those people probably to provide their own housing, but the fact that it's a seasonal deal would probably make it a little hard to find people. You know, you wouldn't want to haul your trailer back and forth. It'd be probably prohibitive or unreasonable to expect somebody to haul it back and forth. So. I have supported the idea of putting state-owned mobile homes in there for them, and that's why we put it in there instead of, you know, 70 versus 400,000.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does that work, Steve? Do they reimburse then the state for their rent?
Yes, they would.
Rent the state?
Unless they're prohibited by a current contract, which I don't think they are. I think they've changed those. I think they would charge a reasonable rent for the employees.
Because I think the employees in, for example, Coldfoot would get 41% adjusted cost of living to their base pay, compensate them for the
right, they would get some expenses. Cost of living adjustment, you're right.
So I would assume that they would be paying
yes.
A rent that would be 41% higher than the rent you'd find.
I don't know what the rent would be, but it's probably not quite that high. I don't think they gouge the state employees on those. I think they try to.
But they gouge us when we pay them 41%.
Well, we've come a long way, I think, in employee housing, trying to move it out of state responsibility and into the private sector, where there is a private sector to take advantage of. But I don't think there's that much of one here. I guess I do it as a reasonable compromise.
Yeah, but there would be some revenue to offset
that
$70,000 expense
there would be.
From the rent.
I view it that way.
And also, just a note, unless those funds are coming from someplace else, it seems like on the fiscal note in FY91, under funding, general fund and total should be $342.91 rather than $272.
You're correct.
But there also should be some revenue to offset that capital expenditure.
Yeah, I have to admit we were kind of working at the last minute to change this, and we didn't get with the department to find out what their revenue would be. But I would anticipate something like, you know, $500 or $600 a month rent off of each one for the 7 months that they're there.
What I think we'd like to do, if we go ahead and approve this fiscal note, is to have some background from the department that we could attach to it. Can we get that, Carol? And what else on this fiscal note?
We could provide
I want an explanation on the capital
I can provide that. As, you know, I don't think the department's necessarily going to like this. You know, they'd like a $400,000 duplex. I think that's unreasonable, and I don't think the committee would support that.
Okay, what's the next fiscal note, Senator Frank?
The next one would be Fish and Game. Well, we're going to zero out the DOA because that's for all for communications equipment that...
So if someone gets lost up there, that's it. They can't.
Well,
they're gone.
Yeah, there's a, you know, a truck comes by pretty often. There's a...
Travel at your own risk.
That's right. I mean, you know, we don't have that kind of communication system on any other stretch of the highways in this state, so that I'm aware of.
Okay, what's the next fiscal note, Senator Frank?
The Fish and Game Department, 14.9.
That's zeroing that one out, too?
No, I think that's very legitimate, and I would ask the committee to approve that one. I think that's important to find out what the effects of opening the road are on the Fish and Game.
That might be to be able to be absorbed in the Fish and Game budget. I don't know who does it. Is that yours, Senator Duncan?
No, that's Senator Sheriff's.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I...
No, Fish and Game.
Oh, Fish and Game.
$14,000. Can you absorb that in your budget?
I don't know. Probably not.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to strike
That's
a balance
what I like.
Between...
It's a real good, concise group of people here this morning. Go ahead, Senator.
I was just
going
to say, I'm trying to strike a balance between fiscal conservatism and trying to address what I view are legitimate concerns addressed by those people that don't want to see the road open.
So that's your justification
that's
for leaving as it is?
That's why I think we should approve it, yeah.
Okay, next fiscal note, Senator Frank. How many more are there?
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
So all the other fiscal notes are zero except for the ones we indicated.
Well, we have the dot puff, we have the Fish and Game, and we have the public safety. The only one we're really zeroing is the DOA, if that's for communications equipment.
Okay. Is there anybody that wishes to testify on this bill? Senate Bill 336 relating to the Dalton Highway.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask Mr. Frank, Senator Frank a question?
Senator Frank, there's a question from the Juneau Senator.
I'm just wondering, how many people do we expect will be using this? I mean, as far as the public goes.
Personally, I don't think it's going to be, you know, something that will cause a great burden to DOTPUF or to public safety.
Well, I guess I was just wondering, I mean, we're going to be approving fiscal notes of about $500,000 here. I was just wondering, you know, is it just for one or two people who want to drive up there?
I think there's a substantial number of tourists who would like to go up there. I think there's a substantial number of resident tourists. You can make the argument that we just opened the road. You know, we've got people, we got a trooper at Coldfoot, we had a trooper up at Prudhoe Bay, but they took them out when we cut the budget. They had a trooper at 7 Mile, they took them out when we cut the budget. So it's not, the department has not been prioritizing this, even in areas that are currently open to the public. If you ask me personally, I'm not sure that we need fiscal notes even as high as we had. I have said, time and again, I'm trying to at least, provide some money to address the concerns. And if I had my way, totally, I'd probably open it and see what the effects were without additional monies, except for maybe Fish and Game or something, just to monitor. And if additional Fish and Game protection was warranted in the future, then we'd either make that decision, based on closing the road. Maybe we'd say, well, we can't afford $500,000 to open the road, and we'd close it, or we'd say, well, the Fish and Game impact isn't so great that we need to put additional people on there. And I acknowledge, that it's expensive and perhaps more expensive than I would do if I was just, a benevolent dictator here.
How many miles is that from the Yukon River to the Arctic Ocean?
It's already open beyond the Yukon.
How many miles are we talking
about? It's about 400.
About 400?
Roughly. But we're only talking about from Disaster Creek, it's only a couple hundred.
So that's 400 one way.
Right, from the bridge up. I think, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's just over 500 from Fairbanks and 520 or so from Fairbanks.
Yeah, that's right. I'm
so I think it must be 120 miles in the Yukon.
One other point on the fiscal note, Senator Frank, there's $12,000 in personal services on the DOT fiscal note. Most of the costs there are in capital costs. Two campsite facilities, 4 vault toilets, information signs, bear-proof litter barrels. Okay, I can see that. But I think they can absorb the $12,000 in their personal services line item.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem doing that. Frankly, you know, I'm not going to... I'm trying in good faith to provide some funds for some fish and game protection. And I'm not, I'm not suggesting that the Finance Committee shouldn't take a close look and, you know, decide for itself what level of funding is appropriate. I've tried to do that. You know, we've cut back from, you know, the department wanted $2.7 million in the first year to open 200 miles of road. We've cut it back substantially back to, about $481 in total of operating capital. If the committee desires to cut it back further, certainly.
Senator Duncan?
Yes, sir.
Any questions?
No.
No. Okay, Senator Fisher?
I just have your
word.
Maybe DOT can better answer this. Is this common for DOT to take care of campsites?
Could we have DOT come forward, please?
Yeah, I'll have to ask Congress if
to. Harry?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Keith Burke, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, it is not uncommon. We try to stay out of the campsite business, but there are a number of locations where historically we have maintained them and have continued to do so. And in a particular instance of the Dalton Highway, there really aren't very many alternatives. There are very few other agencies that are available and around to do that.
Do you maintain any campsites that are in the state park system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I believe we do. I couldn't give you a list of them, but I think we do that on a cooperative basis with the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know, because maybe that's a way to help out the some of those campsites in the Cuna, the Yankers people are always coming down and littering. Maybe the DOT will save the park a little bit more. But anyhow, thanks. I'll find out.
What was that all about?
Well, we have a problem. It had nothing to do with this, but really, some parts of the team are just so overcrowded, and parks that just don't have the money to really maintain the property. And I thought maybe if DOT would want to cooperate a little bit, maybe we could save some money by having DOT go and do some road maintenance anyway.
Okay, is there anybody else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 366?
I've got that same problem, Cody.
My suggestion would be on the DOT fiscal note to reduce the fiscal note by $12,000 on the personal services line. Is there objection to that? Okay. No objection. The question is, do we have a motion to move the bill out?
There is.
Senator Frank?
I would move that we pass out CS for Senate Bill number 366 with individual recommendations along with the accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection to that motion? I thought you wanted to object to it.
I'm going to send do not pass.
Okay. There is no objection to the bill moving out of the committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, exempt that from spinning limit if it passes.
Just add that to the limit on the spinning limit.
Is that
limit.
Inside or outside the spinning limit?
Dalton Highway will be outside the spinning limit.
It's inside right now.
I see that there was some objection.
We also, can we have a motion to change the effective date to be July 1st.
Yeah, I should have said this. I should have said committee substitute. July 1st?
I'm not going to.
Yeah.
Will you make that motion,
yeah.
Senator Frank?
I'll make the motion that we change the effective date to July 1st.
Okay. Effective date July 1st, 1990 on the Dalton Highway bill. For the record, that is Senate Bill 366. Any objection to that motion? I hear no objection, so ordered. Next bill on the calendar, Senator Jay Kurtula's bill. On the slaughter of moose,
another one?
On reindeer.
Gosh,
and we have Kathy Hathaway here to represent Senator Kurtula's office.
Hmm? Who is Kurtula? About two less than you. I've been counting.
Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kathy Hathaway, and I work for Senator Kurtula.
Also, with me at Senator Kutula's request is Matt Fischel, who also works for Senator Kutula, who is familiar with the technical aspects of the bill. Basically, if Mr. Chairman, Senator Kutula is also proposing a committee substitute. There's a letter of support from Representative Foster that he'd...
The policy of the committee on committee substitutes, when we have not seen a committee substitute, is to hold the bill 24 hours, so that's what we'll do.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Yeah. We can take a look at it, but okay. We will have to hold the bill over 24 hours.
You got a committee substitute on still, Chris?
Why don't you go through the... Do you would like us to look at the committee substitute versus the original bill? Is that...
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, would you prefer then that we hold this and hold our testimony?
Let's take a look at the amendments. Why don't you go through it?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To begin with, this bill would provide for state inspection of reindeer meat. And this is viewed as a crucial first step in potentially phenomenal growth in the reindeer industry. The bill is supported by the reindeer herders, meat wholesalers, and retailers throughout the state. Senator Kutula and his staff have spoken to the Alaska Sausage Company, who support it, other wholesalers and retailers, including Bob Bastock and Soldotman, supported it. It's supported by the Department of Environmental Conservation. And in the packets are included some informational materials on the reindeer industry in general. And Matt Fischel, I believe, has more specifics about what is contained in the bill and the need for it.
Mr. Fischel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Matthew Fischel with Senator Kutula's office. This legislation will allow the state to inspect reindeer meat for use in meat products, sausage. This inspection is mandated by the federal government. But the federal government provides no funding for the inspection. It provides reindeer herders with a greater economic opportunity and our current meat industry with a national and international opportunity to market reindeer sausage. The reindeer herders are in support of the legislation as long as the reindeer inspection program is voluntary and is at no cost to the reindeer herders. The Department of Environmental Conservation is in support of the legislation as a means to protect consumers and promote the reindeer industry. And the meat packers are also in support of the legislation. With the passage of this legislation, the reindeer industry is put in a position of potential for phenomenal growth through meat, blood, hide, and horn sales. Currently, these markets are for reindeer horns, blood, hides, and meat, but these markets are in their infancy, and the requirement of meat inspection is the key to further developing these markets. The changes in the legislation from committee substitute for Senate Bill 364 resources to the finance version would be that it allows the meat to be in Section B, page 2, line 21, allows the inspected reindeer meat to be used in federally inspected meat products. And the resources version states satisfies the requirements of 21 U.S.C. 601 through 695 Wholesome Meat Act, allowing the inspected reindeer to be used in state and federally inspected meat products. Mr. Donegan with the Department of Environmental Conservation is here and could explain the changes also. But it just allows for the state to set up a program to inspect the meat, provide that it's wholesome for our consumers, and that it can be used in the other federally inspected meat products, such as sausage. Currently, there's a zero fiscal note on the bill, although the cost is being taken care of through an increment in the governor's budget for DEC.
Questions? Senator Fisher?
Questions.
Maybe.
These are going to be Canadian reindeer that are brought across.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. This would affect both the reindeer that are brought in from Canada and the reindeer that are owned and herded by our Alaska Natives here in the state. Representative Foster's letter that was passed out just now, it talks that, in other words, if a herder, meaning an Alaskan person who has reindeer, wants to sell his product across the counter as reindeer meat, he's allowed to. There is no inspection required. If another herder wishes to sell part or all of the reindeer, that it would be inspected to be used with these other federally inspected meats, beef and pork, for use in sausage. So it's both the Canadian reindeer and the current Alaska reindeer. It affects both.
I guess I'm not clear. As far as federal inspection goes, I was under the impression that if you sell interstate, yes, you have to have a federal inspector present to check the product and through the whole process of the slaughtering, and if you're going to make five products. But what about the Alaskan wholesale or the Alaskan slaughterhouse that does not sell interstate? They're still going to have a federal inspector then?
They currently do for beef and pork that is processed in Alaska, and with the reindeer, it's required when it's mixed with the federally inspected meats of beef and pork. And it's a voluntary program for the people. If they don't want to have the meat inspected, they don't have to. They can sell it across the counter in Alaska. Right.
Senator Zaroff. Senator, any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
From what I can see, this is pretty technical changes on the committee substitute, so I'm not going to... And generally, the rule is that we don't like to have a committee substitute be sprung on the committee, but it's all very technical here, so I don't think there's too many changes from the original bill. Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to mention the same thing there, and I think they're looking at the lateness of the session. This is a Senate bill, and I think we should, if possible...
We just like to have some warning 24 hours in advance. Sometimes we get someone who brings a committee substitute to the table, and it's completely different than the original bill.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chairman. That won't happen again.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Zaroff.
I would, I don't know when would be an appropriate time to entertain a motion to
right now.
The proposed committee substitute, but I would suggest an effective date of July 1 of this year.
Is there an objection to that? Is that enough time to get it in order? Senator Binkley.
Yeah, I've got some concerns with this legislation. Actually, I'd like to work with the sponsor between today and tomorrow or longer if necessary, but we do have some concerns on Nunavak Island where there is some of the language. Maybe before we adopt any amendments to the proposed committee substitute, we could have a date at least to look at that.
Okay. Did you want to adopt the committee substitute that they brought today, or wait on it?
I'd just soon wait until tomorrow.
Sponsor of the bill. And I would suggest...
Suggestion, July 1st, 1990. And they don't have an objection to that. So Senator Binkley can take a look at that subcommittee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Next bill on the calendar is... Senator Zaroff, do you want to be on that subcommittee also?
I'm comfortable with the bill.
You've got enough to do with irradiated foods. An act containing the existence of the Board of Nursing Home Administration providing for effective... Let me just double check. Was there anybody else who wanted to speak on the slaughtered reindeer? Did anybody else want to talk about slaughtered reindeer or testify on it? Or
Mr. Chairman...
What's everybody waiting for? Senator Duncan?
I'd like to make a motion on Senate Bill 372.
Well, let me see what it is first, Senator Duncan.
We can debate it forever, but we're going to pass it anyway, so we might as well pass it right now.
Second, Senator. Senate Bill 372. If everybody will be patient, we're doing quite well on the calendar this morning.
I'm patient. I just don't want to debate this thing forever.
Well, there may be some people that want to testify from the public. I don't know. Is there anybody that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 372? Okay. Senator Binkley.
Yeah, I know this is mandated by the feds to have the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. Seems kind of ridiculous that we have to go through the sunset review all the time on it because it's mandated, it's necessary to have, and I don't even, we may even make an amendment to delete it from the sunset review procedure so we don't have to continue to deal with it.
So put them in there forever, huh?
Or no, we send it into a subcommittee to review that issue.
Fine.
I mean, I think that has to be a policy on not only just the nursing home advisors, but perhaps we should give government an engine of its own. Never have to ever come back to the legislation.
Just put it on autopilot?
Yeah.
Watch out for reefs.
Yeah, watch out for reefs. Just at that, I don't care if we can move it on with you.
Well,
so does Aaron.
Just a second here.
You know, the legislature, if they're not pleased with it, can always come back and eliminate it, or if the federal mandate for it goes away, we can always say.
Do we have anybody here from Commerce and Economic Development testifying the bill? Or? Oh, we do. Okay, come forward, please.
Are they opposed to it?
Well, there may be some problems with the administrators. I don't know. Let's just get a synopsis.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jennifer Stricker, Administrative Officer for the Department of Commerce Occupational Licensing. As stated in our position paper, we support this bill, and the board is needed by federal law in order for the state to continue to receive Medicaid and Medicare funding. It's a three-member board. Their activity up to current date has been relatively small. In fact, last year we even had problems trying to get the board to meet their one mandated meeting.
One mandated meeting a year.
A year, yes.
Any others? Senator Binkley?
Mr. Chairman, we could on page 11, beginning with...
Page 11?
I mean, line 11, page 1 of the bill, delete line 11 and line 12. I think that would accomplish, you know,
that would do nothing.
It deletes the requirement for sunset.
Well, we could sunset them in the year 2000.
08, 03, 010 is the sunset provision.
Yeah, but I think just deleting it here doesn't do anything.
I don't think we want to do that.
I want to check that pretty carefully. You still have the other statute. You have to repeal that statute, not just delete the reference here.
Well, let me see, 080.
Yeah, but I mean, if you just...
I kind of like the idea of a sunset, though. It brings them back before.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Let's move it.
Senator Duncan, will you make a motion to move the bill?
No, sir, I'm not going to.
Senator
Binkley. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent. We move up with individual recommendations, Senate Bill 372.
I want to make a motion.
Okay, I hear an objection. Senator Duncan, are you objecting to the bill? So ordered. Next bill on the calendar is 464, an act requiring a new public school schools built in certain communities to have sloped roofs and providing for an effective date. And that is Senator Zaroff's bill. We have Mr. Ritter is here to testify.
How about the sponsor explain it first?
And the sponsor can go ahead and explain it first, since he's... I didn't want to miss anybody on the list here today. I'm going so fast today.
Thank you, Mr.
That's fine.
For the record, Senator Jarrah, Senate District N. The measure there that I introduced was to basically avert potential for injury to students and damage to schools resulting from structural failures of flat roofs. In the past year, two flat roofs have suffered extensive damage, one resulting in a total collapse. The Senate Hess Committee, of which you have probably the bill before you, and you also have a suggested CS there, but they adopted an amendment or a CS which removed most of the original language of the bill and placed the responsibility for certifying the structural integrity of the school roof with the architect. I have had my staff prepare a finance CS which conforms to the language in Section 2, and these are basically technical changes, with the changes made at the Senate Hess Committee, and also which designates the commissioner of DOE as the person to whom the architect must provide a roof certification. And so I suspect that there are people here in the audience that wish to testify for the bill.
And maybe some
Mr. Ritter?
Yes, my name is Richard Ritter, and I'm here representing the Alaska Professional Design Council. That's a group that includes 10 professional organizations and has over 1,000 members, including architects, engineers, surveyors, code officials, and specification writers. I wanted to make several points. I'll refer to the committee substitute. First of all, although an architect is usually the prime consultant on a school project, he or she would have a sub-consultant who would be a structural engineer who would be responsible for the structure. So it's probably not appropriate to require the architect to certify structure. Secondly, we have a system in the state right now. The registration of structural engineers is intended to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public through proper design of structures. And that's an elaborate system, requires education, experience, and extensive testing. So we have that right now. Secondly, a flat roof is not necessarily a problem if one of the finest roofs you can put in a building is a flat roof. As far as from my point of view, we do something called an insulated ballasted membrane. which has a layer of rubber and an insulation on the top of it, then ballast hold it down, and it makes an excellent roof structure, and we do that all the time. In fact, the Juneau Public Library has a flat roof. Actually, it's not dead flat, it's a quarter inch per foot. So I think the flat roof is not necessarily the problem. I don't have any explanation as to why the flat roofs failed. I can say there's another irony here. We just finished a series of covered play areas for the school district, and they all have sloped roofs. And we put snow cleats on them because the school district had a child injured last year from snow falling off a sloped roof, and so they wanted the snow to stay on the sloped roofs. And so since they were called structures, the city of Juneau requires a 40 pounds per square foot snow load in the design calculation, and we upped it to 60 since they're called structure, and we're going to keep the snow on there. As a suggestion, I have one more comment. It's probably not reasonable or fair to ask a structural engineer to certify that a roof will not collapse, because we have made certain decisions as a culture to design structures within parameters. Most structural engineers in the state, I think, would design to good engineering practices, and they would use the Uniform Building Code, which has certain limitations. We don't design roofs to take a 500-year snow event, for example. The snow that we're having in Valdez this year was astonishing, and those buildings, I'm sure, were not designed to take that. It's probably the same reason that we don't put airbags in all our cars, and that we don't put seat belts in the back. We make certain decisions as a culture as to how extensive we will protect ourselves. Even buildings are designed to certain seismic standards, which have limitations. And if you get an 8 on the Richter scale, it's probably going to knock down some buildings, but we as a society have decided that is not something we're going to design to because of the extensive cost and difficulty. So in that light, I would say a structural engineering state would design to good engineering practices and the Uniform Building Code. And there may be some cases where you have a snow load that is beyond that would have to be dealt with.
Senator Zaroff?
Senator Frank had a question.
Senator Frank?
Thank you. Well, in light of the concern expressed by Senator Zaroff, you know, I mean, legitimate concern about the welfare of his constituents out there in the schools, I mean, what's the answer? You seem to be saying, you know, that we should accept a few roofs failing in high snowfall years. I mean, I guess we don't know if those were structurally deficient, if they perhaps weren't built to code, if code was inadequate, or if it was such an unusually high snowfall year that exceeded the expectations. Perhaps, you know, perhaps the administrators were at fault for not getting the snow removed. I don't know what, you know, what the answers are, but I'd like to see us, you know, figure out what the problems were and perhaps, you know, design a solution around understanding what the real causes were. You know, I'd hate to see us not address a legitimate issue, but I'd also hate to see us address it in the wrong fashion.
I can appreciate Senator Zaroff's concern. I mean, he has a legitimate concern. And it's also my understanding that one of the roofs that collapsed, I don't think it had an excessive snow load. I don't know much about it, but that was my impression. There probably isn't a perfect answer. Right now, there is an elaborate system any school that's designed in the state must be designed structurally by a structural engineer. And the state has an elaborate system as concerning the qualifications of that person. And that person designs the structure, they seal the drawings, and that's probably the first line of defense that the building is designed adequately. There are certain issues that you rely on that person to take care of. We've had schools, we did a school in Cluck Lawn, and because of the nature of the roof design, it was a sloping metal roof, but we had some certain air devices sticking out. The structural engineer was concerned about snow drifts, so he designed for 100 pounds per square foot, which was beyond what was normally required. Now, Cluck Lawn had no requirement for snow load whatsoever. They didn't have any local requirement, nor does the state have a requirement, so that was all based on the engineer's recommendation for good engineering practices. Probably something that would be useful would be to have a statewide building code, and that's something that the Alaska Professional Design Council has been pushing for several years. There are some difficulties, the main one being as to who would enforce it, and I understand that some communities have resisted that because it would require a fair upgrade in how buildings are constructed. But even the Uniform Building Code has certain limitations. It's not going to guarantee that your building is going to hold up in a major snow event, per se.
Senator Frank?
Well, it seems like we wouldn't have to try to, you know, cram a building code down the throats of all the areas of the unorganized borough to address the problem with schools. You know, it seems like we could adopt within the Department of Education, and I'm sure we have some, you know, some standards that require, I mean, we would just have, make sure we have codes in our regulations I see Steve Hole back there. He's probably going to testify. That would be adequate. Now, I still don't know. I'm just reading now the history, and it doesn't... I don't see anything in here. Well, let's see. I'm getting the failure analysis. I don't know whether the thing was built to code, and the code was inadequate, or maybe it wasn't built to code. You know, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I think we should determine that.
There are other issues.
Mr. Hall, are you here to testify on this, too? Let's... I don't see... It doesn't state that it has to be sloped here, does it?
No.
I mean, essentially, it just has to be safe.
And
it's a safety question.
Right.
Senator Zaroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there, that, as I mentioned there, that this the HESCS did away with the flat roof, right? And what it does is it puts at least the somebody's signature there that's responsible to say that we've gone through all of the environmental conditions out here, and we've looked at the maximum snowfall, and this roof, whether it's a flat roof or a slope roof, meets all of those requirements, and I assume that responsibility in designing this.
Mr. Hall?
Mr. Chairman, if you haven't seen The Hunt for Red October, I would encourage you to do that.
I did see it. I liked it.
Finding that submarine was a walk in the park compared to finding who will accept responsibility for the structural failure of a roof. It's literally a lawyer's dream. With respect to the two situations that Senator Zaroff referenced, at Elektnigik, my understanding is the roof was designed to code. At least we required that all appropriate codes be followed. But it was a goofy design. It was a flat roof with a 3-foot parapet around the edge. There's no place for the snow to go. And the failure at Dillingham, I'm told by the superintendent there, was again the result of a goofy design, a flat roof.
What is a goofy design? I mean, how can you explain that in engineering terms to us?
No, sir, I can give it to you in practical terms. It's a flat roof all the way around with a flat roof in the middle that's lower than the surrounding areas.
To get lift up the snow to shovel
down.
Mr. Ritter?
Yes, if there's a difficulty with wind taking off your roof, in the area of zero parapet to around 18 inches, the wind will take your roof off because you have tremendous eddies created. The only way to totally protect your roof from wind blow-off is to have a high parapet. So I would avoid calling that a stupid design. At the downtown library, we have a zero parapet, and we had to go through extraordinary measures to hold down the roof because of the eddies that were created by that low parapet. We would have loved to have gone to a high parapet and solved the problem, but then aesthetically we had problems with proportions. Mm-hmm. So having a high parapet, you could require a high parapet, but then you'd have probably a risk blowing off from wind.
Senator Fisher, then Senator Zaroff.
And that mainly for aesthetics.
What's that now, the high parapet?
Yes.
It could have been, but as I say, a parapet that's lower than 18 inches causes severe wind blow-off problems. You have eddies curl around and create tremendous suctions. As you go past that point, the eddies are no longer a problem with the roof.
Steve, do you know if this was done that way with
1%
of the art money?
Yeah. In the white schools, those are one half.
If I was an architect doing a 3-foot parapet, I would expect the structural engineer to design the roof to hold up the snow if it filled the parapet.
Senator Zaroff?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little clarification on the Dillingham School. Now, I understand that the beam that is causing the problems now, the one that's dropped about 6 inches, was a beam that was replaced after the roof was built. And it was replaced because they thought at that time that there was some flaw in the laminated beam itself. And they since have replaced that, but that beam broke exactly in the same place and probably under the same conditions. And there was nothing there that was indicated that they had to redo that. But, and now to repair that beam, the insurance companies will only pay for an exact replacement of that particular beam. So we're not getting anywhere. We still have the same structural problems out there with the same danger to the students and the faculty.
Bolt some steel plates on the outside of it. Mr. Hall, did you want to respond to that?
Maybe Senator Bickley would want to take responsibility for
that
design.
I'll sign it.
Just a big design by Bickley. Bolt steel plates.
Hey, Senator Frank, you are out of
order. We do have legislative immunity.
Mr. Hall?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to make 2 points. With all due respect to my fellow speaker here, I don't suffer from the same constraints that members of the society do. Frankly, I think there are some school designs that are goofy, or any other pejorative term you want to apply. They simply don't make sense. And in many instances in rural communities, we find community residents shaking their heads because they don't make sense to them either.
And as to the isolation of the architect as the person responsible, in most instances, the consumer, the people who are buying the building, if you will, spending state money, look to the architect as the person in whom their trust is placed to make sure that these things don't happen. Now, I don't know if the architect is the one that ought to be backed up against the wall and held responsible, or if it ought to be the structural engineer, or it ought to be the contractor. The point is, you can't find anybody who's willing to say, yeah, I did that, it's my responsibility. But we do know that the people look to the architect as the one that they interface with on a day-to-day basis, that they expect to make sure that doesn't happen. And it seems to me that the technology exists to create a structure that we can reasonably expect to stay together and not collapse because of a faulty design or something that wasn't taken into account. This legislation doesn't require a slope roof, doesn't require any other particular kind of roof. It just requires that the person responsible for the design of the building certifies that at least the things, the geographic elements, the weather patterns were taken into account in the design of that roof, and it was designed to withstand them.
Senator Binkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't read it that way, Steve. It doesn't say reasonable design. It says designed to prevent an accumulation of snow and ice that would cause structural damage or failure.
Right.
It doesn't say a reasonable design to prevent a reasonable accumulation of snow and ice. I mean, it says to prevent an accumulation of snow and ice that would cause structural damage or failure. What about the instance that Mr. Ritter gave of Valdez, where they get an extraordinary amount of snow? I mean, does it have to be able to accommodate 500 inches of snow if for some reason there's some freak phenomena, a 500-year event or whatever, that accumulates a tremendous amount of snow and nobody goes up there and shovels off the roof? Is the architect then responsible for that?
Senator Binkley, you're right. The word reasonable does not appear. The legislation requires that someone certify that the roof was designed to prevent something, to prevent the accumulation of ice and snow that would result in structural failure. And frankly, I would want that kind of assurance if it were a building in which my children went to school. And if it's in Valdez and 500 inches is something that's likely to occur or possible to occur, then yes.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't say likely to occur or possible to occur. I mean, possible to occur,
yes.
It does. It doesn't say likely to occur.
Possible.
Senator Frank?
Well, on that, I'm just thinking that, you know, an architect could make the assertion, or anybody could make the assertion, that flat roof, you know, wasn't going to fall down with the accumulation of ice and snow. And so I don't know if we've accomplished. I guess my first thought was, well, you better make it a sloped roof so it'll get rid of the snow so there won't be any problem with accumulation of snow. But really, in reading it further, there's the kind of the caveat that the accumulation would have to cause structural damage. And so I guess we really haven't done anything with the bill except require somebody to certify it. And I guess I'm just now starting to understand that.
Okay, we're out of time, and we're going to hold this one legislative day, and we will take up, I apologize about the Power Project Fund for the people waiting on that. We will take Senator Zaroff's bill up first thing tomorrow morning, and then second, we will take up the Power Project Fund so we don't have to have people wait in the audience. And I apologize about that. We did get through five bills that were passed out. Carol, then what we would do is then go to, let's see, how are we going to do on the slaughtered reindeer? So we're going to...
I think we can work that out.
Okay.
It shouldn't take long once we do.
Okay, meeting's adjourned, and I apologize about not getting down the calendar to everybody.
Presentation by consultants for international tax comparison. We're going to make a presentation, and you may introduce yourself as you go, but go ahead and propose it up to you. With the finance committee, now we have Senator Zaroff, Senator Duncan, myself, Senator Fisher, Senator Frank, who will be joining us, Senator Binkley, and Senator Junior, and one of the meetings, you can't make it on time, so maybe you can. So, if everyone wants to leave off.
Good morning, Senator. Good afternoon. I'm from Klein & Associates, an international or technical and economic advisory firm. My responsibilities as far as the project to work with Professor Kemp to try and ensure that the comparisons we were making were reasonable ones, to bring some of the technical input into the discussions and to and to bring some of the areas which are not so easy to put in Financial Times, prospectivity, which we'll come on to. Start the story off. What have we done? We met with the committee first of all in November and then in January, and I think we perceived that the mission we've been given was to try and see if we could find reasonable comparisons.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Darrow?
Yes, are you going to allow the presentation first and then ask questions?
Or we are in the we would much prefer the questions as we go along.
As you go along.
It helps us to relate much better. So, we perceive a mission to try and find some close comparisons around the legislation in other countries and see how we can relate those to. What have we done apart from spending all your money is answer some initial questions which are good key questions which we think everybody has to ask if they're looking at trying to make foreign comparisons. Provided a framework for those comparisons, and when I say provide the framework, we provided that to the revenue, provide them with models and an approach to how we might look at doing some comparisons so they've got an ongoing capability to do those in the future, which I think is critical. Provided some of the model capability and carried out what we would call the first phase comparisons, and some which we'll show you this morning. I'd stress that first phase, and these are in fact draft numbers because trying to work it with four different desperate groups separated by several thousand miles is not the easiest thing in the world. And we've, to the extent that we've got these initial results, we've made some comments on what the results may mean and how the last seems to compare. Again, I'd stress that anything we say here doesn't imply that we've looked at any one company's legislation. We've simply tried to put things on a base where we could make comparisons. So we're talking about what is a base case. In other words, in the numbers we give you, we had to make some assumptions. The first assumption we had to make was, were we going to try and move a group of fields that people decided that they would like to use, Kruger Bay, West Sac, Near Cook, and North Star, for example, one big producing field, and three fields that might be produced about sometime in the future. Our first problem was to decide whether we were going to try and move those fields, so to speak, mentally, into the United Kingdom, Norway, Australia, and Indonesia, which were the four countries we decided for comparison purposes, or whether instead we were going to take the legislation in those four countries and move them to Alaska. And for various reasons, we thought the first phase of any of this work, it was better to do that. In other words, just imagine that you carried out Prudhoe Bay, not using the legislation you had around the island of the British, the Australian, the Norwegian, or the Indonesian. And we did that similarly. Assume that you had one each of those legislations. How would the other three fields, the new fields, how would they look in the future? The base case conditions that we looked at, we assumed all the legislations that we were looking at the results for an ongoing operating. We were not looking for a new play. That impacts, as Professor Temple will say, the status for offsets. It includes exploration costs. In other words, we've not simply looked at development costs, but we've brought forward all the allocatable exploration costs that the revenue could reasonably attribute in a short time frame. That doesn't mean we've got all of them, but we've made some attempt to model these in some sort of full site, the full cost of exploring and developing the field. We've examined the government take, and when we talk about government take, we're including both state and federal, and we've used a series of measures of performance, as we call them, and perhaps Alex might say a word about one or two of those.
Okay, I'm a professor from the specialised in the economics, particularly examining listing and fiscal arrangements. To take up the story from Peter there, we have to examine the behaviour of the fiscal arrangements in different countries on a federal basis. And so we have various performance measures. And we have emphasised in the study what we call the rate of return adjusted for the time value of money. That is, we look at the flow of expenditure outwards in exploration and development costs, and then the flow of income over a long period of time. And there is a problem in determining what return an investor or a government is getting, and because in our field, exploration and development is talking about a very long time period. And so there is a technique called the internal rate of return, which is a rate of return adjusted for the time value of money. The second performance indicator that we've emphasized is what we call net present value.
and that is a measure of the amount of net wealth that petroleum developments can generate. It brings to the present, 1990 economy of this year, the value of all the expected income and all the expected expenditures. And that gives us a snapshot of the value of the whole activity to a company and to a society. To do that, we have to employ a discount rate or interest rate to bring future values down to present values. Because $100 that you receive in 5 years' time is worth much less than it is if you get it today. So that's what we do with the discount rate. And we debated at considerable length what would be an appropriate discount rate for this type of activity of oil exploration and development. At the end of the day, we settled on one of 12.5% in real terms. That is after inflation, which is 4.5% for the future in our modeling. So that means that our discount rate is about 17% in terms that we got expressed in interest rates and so on. Now, that rate was chosen because it's something we feel could be tolerable as seen by an investor, because it has to take account of the risks involved, and it's something that could be tolerable as seen by a government. A government may often use a rather lower rate, and the British government uses 8% in real terms, the Norwegian government 7% in real terms, for example. So it's somewhat in between what an investor might employ and a company might employ. But for this purpose, we thought it was a reasonable compromise.
Question I have is, when you talk about including exploration and development cost, did the industry give those figures to you, or did you come up with those figures?
I think all the figures that we used provided were the base figures by the revenue department. And the revenue department sought to get some input from the companies insofar as they were able to provide it on what those figures should be. And if that's one of the industry people might want to comment on how much they were able to provide.
Well, we were given copies of what the state was going to provide, and we did internal analysis to look at the basis of the reasonableness of those figures. And in situations where we saw unusual variances, those were usually pointed out. So they're not our internal figures, which are, in many instances, confidential. But there is we believe that in the most part, there are just figures that have a reasonable, solid, reasonable range.
And then when you got their comments, did you take their figures, or did you?
They dealt directly with revenue, and then revenue provided the material to us.
Do you feel that the figures that were used are fair and adequate?
I think every attempt was made to make them fair.
Well, Representative Jacob, it was Senator Frank also joined us. He just stepped down. We'll move down here. Questions as we go along, just bring them up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
As Jacob said, escalate the price of the cost of 4.5% and use the base oil price of $14.50 wellhead for our base case, which is equivalent to just on $20, $120 sale price. And then we also examined in the study the impact of higher prices than that and lower prices. In carrying out our analysis, we looked at Prudhoe Bay in dollars of the day, 19 cents as well as 19.5. And for all the other fields, we examined it, so it was 99.
Yes,
to
make meaningful comparisons, helpful to show it in $1990. So for all the future fields, we to arrive at $1990, which is something we can reasonably compare. And also comparisons between fields which are being developed at different times, which would be compared at the moment.
Well, so much for our base case. That gives me an opportunity
aspect of the work focuses on the
Industry finance, and then I'll go into details of what kind of, or what types of financings are available today in the industry. And you find that, I have actually observed that in Alaska, there is a great deal of presence by merchant bankers, what we call them, merchant bankers, which in New York is called investment bankers. These are extremely sophisticated organizations in terms of their capabilities for analyzing oil industries, and they are actually a driving force for initiating deals and moving companies from one area to the other by actually taking the initiative rather than just being given the authority to act on their behalf. Now, those are discussed in the report. I then go on to other aspects of petroleum investment. Strategic decisions of companies. If a company leaves a region, the question is not just related to its tax in that particular jurisdiction. There was a period that, say, a company like Chevron was putting up its assets for sale, and everyone said, see, industry is leaving Alaska. Well, that could be a strategic decision. A lot of companies in the region, that's nothing to do with their tax factor. Existence of production costs. If an oil company invests in a particular region and the well is ready to produce, the last thing you want is to be told, come back and restrict your production. You have planned to invest for that particular production profile and you want to get it out in the most efficient and optimal way. So, in countries that we have chosen, basically UK, Norway, Australia, and Indonesia is part of OPEC, and OPEC is subject to production quotas. So that a company investing there may be suddenly told, you cut back by X percent, and they have no say in that, which is a variable absent in Alaska. Moreover, in another country that we chose for the analysis, namely Norway, although the country is not part of OPEC, they voluntarily withhold their production. And last year it was 7.5%, this year it's 5%. So that is again suboptimal for industry. I talk about consequences of contracts. Mixture of companies acting in Alaska. That is really trying to say how many companies are in other regions and how they compare with Alaska. And what is noticeably absent in Alaska is the presence of independents. So the numbers are something like 118 license holders in UK, and their concentration in the hands of so many is confined. 94% of the industry is in the hands of 39 companies, and the rest are in the hands of 79 companies. So that comparison again is drawn. And I look at two more tax jurisdictions, Netherlands and Canada, and finally I discuss government relationship in these countries we've chosen, Britain, Australia, Norway, and Indonesia, Canada, and Netherlands are just invited to get part of the report. And I give examples of how companies have been harassed by industry, how relationship improved. And finally, there's a mention of mechanisms to improve industry relationship and how coordinated policies can help.
So before you go, could might do the committee some good, just very briefly, if you just left us know, let us know what your PhD is in.
My PhD is from Cambridge in England and in economics. The focus of that particular PhD was actually expenditure on oil and subsequent to that PhD, that focused on OPEC expenditure, and then I was given a research project by done at University of London. I am faculty at London University Imperial College, where the UK government gave me a large project to look at expenditure policies of UK in the light of new oil revenue. And the results of that were published in books that came out. And after that, I have advised the government of Norway on their expenditure policies and UK in the revenue.
Okay, thank you.
Returning to our base case, we'll maybe now start off on the numbers, and just to show you a big graph to start with, you'll see a lot of graphs, and they will be tables, plots, which of which this is a blow-up of one. And we'll either be showing you the net present value, which Professor Kemp already described, and there'll be a table or bars like this, and this is the first one, which is the base case, and it shows how much above the 12.5%, how much additional discounted net revenue above the 12.5% threshold that we took was achieved under the Alaskan legislation, and then how much would have been achieved under the British, Norwegian, Indonesian, and Australian. So these are just measures of how that might have performed if that legislation had been in place. And it's important to come back to this to recognize all the time, but nobody discovered a 10 billion barrel field in those countries during this period.